Now we're turning back to Daniel in chapter 8, and having been introduced again to the four empires in chapter 8, we zero in on one in particular, and the appearance of those, or at least two of those, who would have great impact upon the church and church history. So in chapter 8, and I'll just go into the verses, and it's more or less just a going over the texts, the verses, and I think they're pretty self-explanatory. And if at any point in the earliest part of the chapter you were to lose your train of thought as to who we're referring to, in the chapter itself, you have the interpretation, so I don't really have to do anything because it's there for you. Who is this? We might say at the beginning of the chapter, and then Gabriel, the angel, is sent to explain to Daniel exactly what he's seen. So there's no difficulty in this. But in, notice what is significant at the very beginning of the chapter is where Daniel in his vision is taken to have the vision. So you'll see what I mean if I hopefully explain it correctly. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, so he's still going back in time, remember, Darius has already conquered Babylon. We're told that at the end of chapter 5. He told us last week, as it were, in chapter 7, in the first year of Belshazzar, he had this vision, and we looked at that vision. Now he says, in the third year of Belshazzar, I had this vision. So in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first, in the first year of Belshazzar. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Ulai. Well, he's saying this occurred when the Babylonians were still in power, when Belshazzar was still the king of Babylon. He had this vision. He's taken to a place called Shushan. If that sounds familiar to you, and it should, as a Bible reader, you read of Shushan in the book of Nehemiah. That's where Nehemiah was, also known as Susa. At this point, it seems the Elamites are either still an independent nation, or Babylon has conquered them and their allies. But as you know, in the Persian Empire, this became one of their chief cities, their three royal cities. Indeed, it became the chief city of its administration and its political center. So even before the Persians have overrun Babylon, Daniel's taken to the very center of the Persian Empire, its HQ, if you like, and he's having this vision about them. God's showing him, again, he's an omniscient God. It's his purpose, it's his plan that's being worked out. And Daniel's been shown this beforehand. So I saw in a vision, verse 2, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Ulai. Now there isn't actually a river as such. It was a canal that connected two rivers that flowed into the Persian Gulf. That's what Daniel's referring to here. Then I lifted up mine eyes, verse 3, and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. Now, we know this is the Medes and Persians, isn't it? We saw that last week. The bear that was raised up on one side, as if more powerful on one side than the other. And that's exactly what happened in the empire of the Medes and Persians. The Medes were in the ascendancy at the outset of the empire, but not for very long. In fact, most people, as I think I mentioned last week, speak of the Persian Empire. They've forgotten the Medes. They weren't there for very long. But here Daniel sees the two peoples, if you like. This ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. And of course that's the Persians and their ascendancy and their domination and control within the empire. What he saw this ram doing, verse 4, was pushing westward, northward, and southward. Well, of course, they're coming from the east. Persians, Iran today. So they're coming from the east, so the east is behind them. They're coming westward. They're coming towards Palestine. And northward and southward, north and south, Mesopotamia. That's exactly what the Persians, the Medes Persians, did in their conquests from their own homes, as it were, or their own center. So it pushed westward, north, and south, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And as you know, one of them, perhaps the most famous of their kings, was actually known as that. He was Cyrus the Great. So here we have them spreading, all conquering empire. No one could withstand them. Verse 5. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. That's swiftness. This ram, if you like, he-goat, coming from the west was so swift, so powerful. Why its feet didn't appear to touch the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Oh, a one-horned goat. It's almost unicorn-like. Well, of course, we're told in the explanation later, this is Alexander the Great. This is one particular king. This man, 33, when he died, has a vast empire like no other. He it is that opposes the Medes and Persians, the all conquering Medes and Persians. So look, verse 5, and as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west. Well, of course, Macedonia and Greece. And on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran on to him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close onto the ram, and he was moved with choler or rage against him, and smote the ram and broke his two horns, the combined peoples, Medes and Persians. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, and he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. I mentioned last Lord's Day, within 3 years of battles between Alexander's forces and the Medes and Persians, he completely obliterated the Persian Empire. He set out on his conquests at the age of 20 as the supreme commander of the Grecian forces, Macedonian forces, and swiftly swept the world, built a huge empire, as you know. Well, verse 8. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. Again, the accuracy of the Bible in these things. When the horn was strong, Alexander didn't reach old age. He didn't grow old and frail and feeble. He didn't die of natural causes or age. He died at the age of 33 in Babylon. Still a relatively young man, of course, even for those times. In the peak of his powers, he's cut down. When he was strong, the great horn was broken. Now, Daniel's writing this, remember, 200 years before Alexander the Great appears. This is quite remarkable. It's why the enemies of the Bible, as I've repeatedly said, can only come up with, this was written after the events. Well, it's so precise, you would think so. Be the only way it could be if you were just mere human, but not if you're an infinite God who's giving this prophecy and these words to his servant, which is exactly what he did 200 years before Alexander appears. We're reading, or Daniel was told, what would happen to him. In the midst of his power, this wonderful empire, this great king, would be just cut down. And again, that's what history tells us. And look, verse 8, it gets even more precise and quite unremarkable. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. And that's four of his generals, of course. And I think last week I actually gave you the names of them and where they went to rule their various powers. The one that's particularly worthy of noting, and again, I'll just give you these. There was the general Cassander, who was given the region of Macedonia. There was a general called Lysimachus. He was given Thrace in Asia Minor. A third general was Seleucus, and that's the one particularly worthy of note for what's to come, even in this chapter. Seleucus, general of Syria, and then lastly, Ptolemy over Egypt. So those four generals divided up the empire, as it were. And that's what we're being told here. Again, 200 years before these things occurred. And verse 9, and out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. So from one of these four generals, this little horn appeared and waxed exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and particularly toward the pleasant land, Palestine, Israel. That's particularly worthy of note. Verse 10, it waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. The reference to host, to the stars, is to God's people, of course. So this particular horn that comes from one of the generals, adopting the title king, has a particular interest in Palestine. This will be, as we know, the Seleucids, the Seleucidae, from General Seleucus, their first general. He was given Syria and that domain. He has a particular interest. So he is invading Israel. But this particular little horn from amongst the Seleucidae kings does some things particularly hideous. You'll know the name when I come to mention it in particular, but just take note again of the accuracy of what happened here. This little horn, waxing great, even to the host of heaven, casting down some of the host of the stars to the ground, stamped upon them. Verse 11, yea, he magnified himself, even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Practice, it acted. It's just a term for action. He was actively pursuing. The reason we're told he was so successful, verse 12, was by reason of transgression. You see, when God's people sin, when things are not right, when things are not in place, when there is disobedience to God, when there is transgression. Now, Jeremiah preached to the people before these events, even before the Babylonians come, and he was warning them that God was going to judge. Again and again, the prophets preached and warned. And you know, we lose the blessing of God. You lose the help of God. You lose that nearness, that communion. As an individual, you lose that sense of fellowship. There's a distance begins to grow. Every Christian that's ever become disobedient to God, or drifted, or allowed coldness to overcome, or neglect the use of the means of grace, knows what this begins to be like. And things that you had power over, or measures of control over, they begin to take control again, reassert themselves in a life. Well, that this is what happened to the nation over and over again. When God withdrew his presence and his help, they were prey to their enemies. Their enemies overrun them so easily. So that's why we have to make strides and robustly and fervently pursue righteousness, closeness to God, obedience to God. You'll have no church. You'll have no Christian witness. We'd have no Christian life if we are not obedient, if we lose his favor. And we're told this, Daniel's told, this king, this little horn, it's Antiochus IV, by the way. He took the name Epiphanes and attached it to his title. So he became Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Now this tells you a little bit about himself. Epiphanes actually means God displayed, God manifest. Now, you know, Emmanuel means God with us. That's a title of Christ himself. This man, Antiochus the Fourth, one of the kings from Seleucus, the general from Syria in that region, that's who's being referred to here. He's the one that took away the daily sacrifice. He banned it. He threw down parts of the temple. The place of his sanctuary, verse 11, the end of the verse, was cast down. He's the man that had the audacity, and you've heard this perhaps before, but he took the altar of the Lord, he put an altar on top of it to Zeus, and he offered up pigs on the altar. This is the man that so defied heaven, defied the Jewish God, the God Jehovah. This was to stamp his authority. He took that title, God manifest. He actually come to believe he was a manifestation of the chief god of the Greeks, Zeus himself. That's why he took the title. But those around him, little did he know, or maybe he did get to know, had another name. And they played on the term Epiphanes. Epiphanes, God manifest. They called him Epimenes. Very phonetically similar. And Epimenes means the mad one. That's what they knew him as. And they were right. So capricious. Acted on a whim. Was a right strange and wicked individual. That's why, look, verse 11 then. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. He openly defied God. He worshipped Zeus. He put an altar to Zeus in the temple. He offered up pigs, which he knew were unclean to the Jew. By him the daily sacrifice was taken away. Verse 12, an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. They were handed over, even to this king, this man, into his hands. And we're told the reason. It was because of transgression. The transgression of the Jews, that is. That's why it was happening. Here was God's chastising rod on the people. But then look, verse 13. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot? And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Maybe you've heard in history of Joseph Maccabeus, or the Maccabeans. They were Jewish zealots, and they fought against this Antiochus and the Seleucidae kings. In 164, Antiochus died. Joseph Maccabeus then led his forces, his people, Jewish zealots, against what was left of the powers that be then, the Greeks, the Seleucidae. And he brought about a cleansing of the temple. History before it happened. You're reading it. Daniel was reading it. So the 2,300 days, some have tried to be very precise, and they've said that that's literally what it was from a particular point in time, counting the time down. It just seems it's a certain time. God was saying, here's a time span. But this will happen. The key thing is that the sanctuary would be cleansed. This was God's judgment, but in his mercy, he would restore the people, as he does for those that genuinely repent and turn from their sin. Verse 15, it came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Uli, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So we know it's an angel that's with him. Gabriel, one of the few, well, one of the two perhaps named angels in the Bible, if you take Michael as the other one. But Gabriel is the one who sent to tell Daniel or expound and explain the vision. And this Gabriel, this angel, is spoken to with a man's voice. Well, we know who's speaking now and commanding Gabriel the angel. So Christ is in control. Christ speaks to Gabriel. It's Christ that tells him to explain to Daniel. He's always the mediator between God and men. So here, this voice of the man speaks and tells Gabriel to make Daniel understand. So he came near, verse 17, where I stood. And when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Well, we're going to lead up to the end of the old covenant, of course. This is up to the time of Christ. But typically, things will stretch out way beyond to the final time. So what we see this Antiochus do, he typifies the end time desecration, the end time attacks, persecution and oppression of the church. But we're told that the one who'll do that comes out of the fourth empire. So we're looking at what's come out of the Greek Empire. There's another one after that, the Roman. There's a little horn comes out of that and does something similar. So we're seeing typified this oppression, this persecution upon the Lord's people and the church. But for the present, as it were, for the end of the old covenant, that's what's being revealed to Daniel and in this particular chapter. So in verse 18, now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be the recovery of the temple, the cleansing of the temple, Antiochus disappearing. Remember, it's 200 years before Alexander the Great comes from the time of Daniel. It's another 150 years after that that Antiochus has appeared and done his work. He was born 215 BC. His sort of reign was from 175 to 164 BC. That's way down. So 200 years to Alexander, another 150 to Antiochus, 350 years. That's why it's put in the language that it is here, that he's letting him know the time of the end. The end of this, the end of this persecution, the end of this empire, the recovery, if you like, of the people of God in measure, because it's still Old Testament. But verse 19, and he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king, the great king, the one great leader of the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great himself. Verse 22, now that being broken, the first king, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power, nothing like the power of Alexander. It's divided into four, goes without saying. And verse 23, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, in sin being the cause of judgment, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. This is again a reference to Antiochus, his reasoning power. He was quite mad. He was an eccentric, but he had a way with words, it seems, and it's just describing how he went about his business, his character and the way that he spoke, his influence. If he couldn't threat or that wasn't felt appropriate, he had ways to win people round, to have them on his side. We're told he's helped by a power that wasn't his own. The powers of darkness are always about their business. If not named specifically, that's what's referred to. Power wasn't his on his own. No, remember, it's still the same, friends, by the way. Don't think this is primitive and back in history and devils and demons running about and people like Antiochus, you know, primitive times and having powers over such primitives. But you know, we're 21st century, man. We know what's going on. There's no power of darkness going to influence me. I'm too smart for that. That's Bible stuff and Bible history. The people that talk or think like that actually are manifesting just how duped they are. Just how real and effective the powers of darkness are, that they can have philosophies and theories and opinions that men just take in like big sponges, soak them up, then rehearse them and say the same things. That's why kids laugh. You talk about the devil. He's a cartoon character. That's something from history. That's myth and fable. And all the while, the one doing the real laughing are the powers of darkness, because they've got them where they want them. The Bible, old fable, tales, myths, back there when people were primitive, they fell for all this. You know, all these demon-possessed people that the Lord healed. We call that epilepsy, you know. Well, it may have been. What caused it? Bible tells us what caused it. Christ addressed them. Come out of them. Doesn't happen today. Unless you're foolish enough to go looking for the devil and you seek his power and help and you want him in your life, that'd be a foolish thing to do. God might just say, well, go then. No, he was subtle. He was helped by a power, not his own. People can be, we say, devilishly clever. The devil's clever. Are you being duped by him? How's your Christian walk and life? How's your prayer life? Has he distracted you? What progress are we making? Powers of darkness, influences? Absolutely. Well, it's happened. Here we are. Time's almost gone. We'll look. Verse 24. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper and practice, act, engage, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. Some of them. Christians fall in times of battle. Not always the wicked. We're all here. Genuine. Serving Christians also will suffer if a nation suffers. We're part of it. We live amongst them. If God judges the nation and certain consequences of his judgment fall upon all the peoples. But we stand safe in the Lord. That's the point. Verse 25, through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace destroy many. Can have a false peace as well as battles. Can be duped by the flattering word as well as the intimidation and the physical attack. Whatever strategy works. That's what the enemy will use. He may not frighten you into turning away from God. He might place next to you somebody who's the epitome of sweetness and light. And they've no time for God. And they can influence you and they can take you away from the truth. And from walking with the Lord, they can make you stop thinking about the things of God. All the entertainments of this world, that's the powers of darkness intention. That's what they're about. Craft as well as oppression. Saints are suffering both today, aren't they? Some are languishing in cells. Some have been tortured, beaten physically for their faith. Others are being seized and snatched away, led away from the things of God. That's the intention. Well, verse 26, and the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true, that stamp of God's authority and seal upon it. These things are not myth. These things are not inaccurate. These things are not guesswork. These things, Daniel, are true. Shut up the vision. That means secure it. Keep it. Protect it, speak it, reveal it, but hold on to it because it's real. Don't let it go, and for it shall be for many days, until the many days. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. Well, he was back his diligent self. He walked with his God. He served the king where God had placed him. He did his business and his work. And that's to be true of us. Now next week, well, I'm not here, but 2 weeks, God willing. Chapter 9, the power of praying, the place of praying. In the decree of God. Where do you ever see in scripture this notion, this idea, or any teaching that says, because it's going to happen, don't pray. You don't need to pray. After all, if God says it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Why pray then? It's not necessary, is it? Well, actually, it's the opposite. That's the fatalistic view. That's not faith. That's fatalism. No, Daniel knows, and he knows what's about to happen in the immediate future when we get to chapter 9. He knows what's going to happen within 70 years. He sees the 70 years exile is up. He knows from Jeremiah, and we can look at some quotes from Jeremiah, that the exile would be for 70 years. And what's that do for Daniel? It makes him sit there and say, 70 years are up. Let's just wait till it happens. No, when he reads what God had promised he would do after 70 years, he starts praying for it. It motivates him. He doesn't have this view of the sovereignty of God, that because God says he'll do it, there's no need to pray. Actually, it's the motivation for his prayer, and he knows when he prays for this, it's going to happen. So you'll read that in the first couple of verses there in chapter 9, if you're ahead of me. But God is sovereign, and remember, the setbacks that we have perhaps in life as an individual, the discouragements, the disheartening, the growing cold, examine, is it because I'm walking well with the Lord? I can suffer these things if I'm close to God, but I'll know I'm close to God. I know this will be in God's purpose for my blessing and benefit, but ask, is it because I'm not close? Is it because I'm drifting? Is it because I've turned? I'm no longer zealous. I'm so cold in heart of the things of God. I'm just going through the motions. Then we need to get back to God. We need to be right again. We need to know his closeness and his nearness. We're powerless without him. Sin will overcome.